Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 55. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your immense generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. November's prize is a copy of The Raven's Widow, a novel of Jane Boleyn by Adrian Dillard. A huge thank you to Adrian for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Sir Walter Raleigh and his relationship with Elizabeth I is Matthew Lyons. Matthew is a writer and historian based in London. His most recent book, The Favourite, is the first book-length exploration of the love affair between Walter Raleigh and Elizabeth I, and was published by Constable and Robinson in 2011. He's also the author of Impossible Journeys and There and Back Again in the footsteps of J.R.R. Tolkien. My conversation with Matthew straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Matthew. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk Tudors with me. So I thought we could start by you introducing yourself and telling us about what sparked your interest in Tudor history.
Well, I'm a writer and historian. I actually studied English at university, but as part of that, I got increasingly interested in really sort of the historical context to the things that I was studying, particularly in the Renaissance period and into the Restoration. I did an MA in sort of Renaissance and Restoration literature, and actually, funnily enough, my primary interest originally historically was sort of the rest of the Civil War and the Restoration in that period, and then, but whilst at the same time being much more interested and excited by, you know, the literature of the Elizabethan age, and sort of slowly the two things kind of came together as I've grown older. I mean, I think certainly like a kind of school age, it was you know, Elizabethan drama that really excited me. It was, you know, obviously you start reading Shakespeare at school, but then, you know, there's Marlowe and Jonson and Kidd and Milton and Webster and all these, you know, extraordinary writers with such different voices. And I think kind of the profusion of voices, it was something I found really exciting. And just the abundance of you know, the kind of the cultural explosion that took place in, you know, the latter half of the 16th century was I know it's a cliche, but it's not really like anything else in English literature. And you have this, you know, I suppose it's the there's a new marketplace, I suppose, you know, there's a fee paying audience, there's print, and suddenly you have this great new environment for people who, you know, might not have had creative outlets or certainly literary creative outlets in the past. They suddenly have these great opportunities, and you know, that's always been very exciting to me anyway. I mean, I was thinking about this, if there was like one book that really brought everything together for me, and it's I think it was 1984, 1985, a book by a writer called Charles Nicol. It's a biography of Elizabethan writer Thomas Nash. It's a book called A Cup of News. And you know, there's not a lot of biographical information about Nash, really, but it's what he does brilliantly is brings the, you know, the period to life and uses Nash's writings really in an extraordinary way to kind of, you know, vivify the period. And that kind of really opened my eyes, I think, to kind of the possibilities of history writing.
So you've written several books, including one entitled The Favourite, Raleigh and His Queen, which is about Sir Walter Raleigh and his relationship with Elizabeth I. Now, before we delve into this quite fascinating relationship, could you tell us a little bit about Walter Raleigh's family and his early life?
Yeah, well, he came from, I mean, we would say, you know, he came from, you know, solid gentry stock or something. But I mean, he, you know, contemporaries thought of him as having come from really quite a poor background. You know, people said he was a bare gentleman, poor in his beginnings and things like that. And, you know, when he fell from, you know, grace, people said, well, he could hardly fall far enough to get back to where he came from, that kind of thing. So, you know, he's, yeah, sort of gentry family. I mean, quite very embedded in the Devon community. I mean, I don't even know if there's, you know, villages now that bear the family name, Coombe Raleigh and Collerton Raleigh and places like that. And actually, the house that he was born in is still there. It's private ownership, I think, or was last time I looked. And it's, you know, a nice look. It's a nice house, but it's not anything like a kind of, you know, country house or anything like that. It's a gentry house. And his father was very much, you know, seafaring man. But I mean, I think the two things that kind of interest me about kind of his family background is one, they're you know, fervent Protestants at a time, you know, in the West Country, mid part of the 16th century, West Country in particular, that was a very live issue. And, you know, there was an uprising when Edward VI, you know, tried to impose the Book of Common Prayer. And Walter Raleigh, Walter's father, Walter Raleigh, was very much involved in that. And, you know, at one point had to, you know, run for his life and hide in the church to escape kind of like a lynch mob. So there's all that kind of background, very kind of, you know, intense antagonisms and, you know, fierce, I don't want to say debates because it's more than that, it's life and death stuff. You know, there hasn't, you know, the Siege of Exeter, which again, you know, Walter's father was involved in, you know, thousands of people died. It's not small stuff. So he grew up in that environment. But the other thing I think a lot of people miss about Raleigh, certainly when I came to look at him, it didn't seem to be something that was much talked about, was his connections on his mother's side. As we know, Elizabethan society, you know, kinship and family connections are incredibly important. And so his mother, Catherine, had a number of sisters. One was married to Sir Anthony Denny, who was one of Henry VIII's gentlemen of the bedchamber and so on, and who was one of the executors of Henry VIII's will, and was there when Henry VIII died. So a very key figure in like late Henrician court. And then another sister called Cat Astley, who was Elizabeth I's governess and later chief gentleman of her privy chamber. But the thing about Cat Astley is she's kind of like a mother figure for Elizabeth, you know, really, you know, there throughout her life. Well, I mean, Cat Astley died in the 60s, but through, you know, all her young life, she was there, you know, governess, and later, you know, when she was those under threat in Mary's reign and so on. Cat Astley's there through all of that from the very beginning right up to you know, 10 years or so into her reign. So she's a very important figure emotionally in Elizabeth's life. And I think that's actually key. We'll talk about this a bit later, but I think that's key to an understanding of Elizabeth's connection with Walter himself.
I actually love learning about all those connections, because, you know, sometimes you can read about these people forever and you miss those little connections. So I'm glad you brought those up. So when does he actually make his debut at the Elizabethan court?
This is a good question. I mean, you know, I think we'll probably talk about, you know, Raleigh myths a bit later, but probably the most famous one is the cloak on the ground.
You know,
he's sort of such a you know, celebrity kind of figure. People wanted, you know, a moment when he introduced himself and he emerged onto the stage. But you know, no evidence that that actually happened. That was first written about in 1662, I think. It doesn't appear before then, and there's no kind of anything like a contemporary record of it. Yeah. So it's people wanting to kind of dramatise the entrance to court. The truth is that he was kind of around the fringes of the court from, say, 1580 onwards. He was caught up in a couple of quote unquote affrays in, you know, on the fringes of the court in 1580, and spent a few weeks in, first in the Fleet Prison and then in Marshalsea. I suppose he's had, you know, I suppose a certain amount of fame, for want of a better word, before that, because he was involved. 1578, he was involved in his half brother Humphrey Gilbert's failed voyage, sort of search for the Northwest Passage and so on, to the Americas. Riley came out with some credit, so he had a certain sort of notoriety before then. I suppose you first kind of see him kind of at the end of 1580. He went to Ireland as a captain under Baron Grey of Wilton. There was a small kind of Spanish invasion. I suppose that's the right word. It's like 600 or so Spanish soldiers who landed at the west of Ireland, a place called Smerwick, if I've pronounced that right. And essentially, English army went over there, and the Spanish surrendered, and they were all like massacred, essentially. Very brutal episode, and Riley was very involved in that. But he supposedly, or someone supposedly, found some important papers on one of the prisoners' bodies, and Riley took them back to court, and that seems to be the point at which he kind of gets noticed. But then, you know, he's kind of on, you know, still kind of marginal figure, really. And doesn't really, you know, he goes with Leicester when the Duke of Anjou goes back to, you know, the Low Countries, sorry, to France in 82. He's kind of part of that entourage. So he's kind of, you know, working his way in. You don't really begin to see him until sort of 83, 84. People start gossiping about him, and there's a German tourist, I suppose, came to the court in 84, von Wedel. Or von Wedel, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, and he talks about Riley and Elizabeth being lovers. People are seeing him there, but there isn't any sort of really strong kind of public status, I guess you would say.
All right, and so let's talk a little bit more now about Riley and Elizabeth. What was their relationship really like?
But yeah, I mean, you wonder about this. I mean, obviously, you do have people gossiping about them being lovers and so on in the way that people always gossip about Elizabeth with her favourites or courtiers more generally. And I think one of the interesting things about their relationship and why it's sort of fascinating is there's a kind of paradox about it, in that it's an intensely public thing. You know, people are gossiping about them, seeing them, hating Riley for his you know, connections and so on. But it's so private that there's, in many ways, there's no trace of the intimacy. It's a public nature of it, but the invisibility of it is kind of a really interesting thing. In many ways, there's no paper trail. You know, there's no love letters or, you know, there's an exchange of poems and that kind of thing. And obviously, he wrote quite a lot of poems about her. I think there's only one back. And that kind of public-private status, you know, I think one of the things it may suggest is, you know, its intimacy is predicated very much on the kind of physical closeness, on him being at court, and it's conversational. It's very much a one-to-one thing. His, you know, as everyone knows about Riley, his you know, rise to greatness, if that's what you want to call it, is predicated on his literal closeness to the Queen and on his presence at court. I said a bit earlier, there's no paper trail, you know, because there's no love letters with that kind of thing. But you could say that paper trail is the rewards that were showered on him through the 1580s. There's an extraordinary amount of things, and you know, essentially money in the form of land and monopolies and so on given to him. And then you have the paper trail of his poems, you know, which you know, some of which are really quite extensive. I mean, famously, there's the papers at Cecil House. There's a long poem, like over 500 lines, called supposedly the 21st book of the ocean to Cynthia. The ocean being Riley, and Cynthia being one of his sort of names for Elizabeth. So, you know, people have always said, did he really write 21 books? It's, you know, it's possible. You know, he was a, you know, prodigiously creative and hardworking man, so it's possible. There's a lot of poetry from him to her, which is very interesting in itself, because it's the dynamic between them is very much that kind of he's in supplicant, and you know, looking up to her. She's the moon in kind of the iconography, and then she's kind of reassuring him about her favour and constancy and so on. And her poem exchange we have between them, that's very much the tenor of her poem, is be not afraid kind of thing. So, yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, why? What does she see in him? I mean, I think, as I said a bit earlier, I think the connection, the familial connection, I guess, with Cat Astley is the really important one emotionally for her. You know, he's a connection to someone who gave her enormous strength and support through her life. But, you know, it's also true that he was tall, he was 6 foot in a period where people were not 6 foot very much, handsome, you know, very eloquent, very witty, obviously charismatic. We'll talk about that a bit later, but obviously extraordinary charisma. So there's lots of reasons why, you know, she was attracted to him as a companion or friend or whatever you want to call it. As with a lot of Elizabeth's, or I think probably all of Elizabeth's, you know, lovers, quote unquote, I think that's at best speculative and almost certainly untrue. I mean, I don't think there's certainly no evidence that she and Raleigh have an affair. What would the evidence look like? We don't know. But you know, there's no question that they were very, you know, intimate. I mean, Cecil wrote to someone in, I think, 1585, saying that Raleigh could do more damage in an hour by talking to Elizabeth than he, Cecil, could do good in a year.
Yeah, so, that's a fantastic quote, that one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it may actually be do more good than we, meaning anyone can do it in a year. It says two things. One about the extent to which Elizabeth, you know, took his advice and listened to him, and also very much about why people didn't like Raleigh, is that he had this kind of power and influence that really wasn't rooted in land or the just hereditary type and so on. It wasn't rooted in any of the things that power was normally rooted in. He wasn't on the Privy Council, so he didn't have a formal role. That's something he, you know, certainly later on, I think, resented quite a lot. So she never formalised his status. His influence is what is very much dependent on her good favour. Whilst she showered rewards on him, she never formalised his role as an advisor, as a statesman, as, you know, in the way that other key people, you know, Walsingham or whoever, were. So I think, you know, he's very, he has power, but it's kind of very vulnerable. It's quite an interesting dynamic.
That is interesting. And I was going to ask you, like, obviously Elizabeth favoured him a lot, but what did his contemporaries think of him? But you've kind of already mentioned that he was a bit disliked.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people commented on, you know, his insolence and pride, and, you know, there were people around him who were incredibly loyal to him, particularly in, you know, I suppose you'd call it the seafaring community, and you know, the proto-scientific community. There are lots of people who were very, you know, fiercely loyal to him, but at court, he was very disliked. Well, partly because, you know, who's this guy come from nowhere who suddenly has, you know, all this influence on the Queen? It's kind of scary. But also, he, you know, I think he, for want of a better word or phrase, flaunted his status. He had a reputation for dressing very ostentatiously, very wealthy, you know, flaunting his wealth, and in an age where, you know, the way you dressed said a lot about your status and clear hierarchies about who could wear what, you know. So people didn't like that, you know. By all accounts, he was deeply unpopular, you know, with people as well. I mean, we'll talk about this a bit later, because that changes almost overnight. But, you know, through his peak, you know, under Elizabeth, the peak of his power and influence, yeah, he's distrusted and disliked, but, you know, because he has access to the Queen, and people didn't like that.
Yeah, scary thing, isn't it? Exactly. And so you talked about the fact that Elizabeth didn't really formalise his position at court. So what was his career like after the 1580s? What did he do at the court?
Just talking about the 1580s, I mean, in terms of kind of, you know, appointments and stuff, he was knighted in 1585, and then he has things like the wine monopoly, the monopoly on broadcloth, you know, big export... cloth's big export thing for England at the time, and Vice Admiral of the West, Lord Lieutenant of Cornwall. He's Knight of the Shire in Parliament. Elizabeth nominates him to succeed Christopher Hatton as Captain of the Guard. In 1587, he gets that, and he has huge grants of land in Ireland. When Anthony Babington, the Catholic traitor, I guess, you know, is executed, Raleigh gets his lands. Then, you know, you have things, you know, people obviously associate Raleigh with exploration. He gets a patent for colonisation in 1584, and a charge to found a colony in 87. I mean, these are all kind of big gifts. So, I mean, then that, you know, 1580 is very much the peak of his status. I mean, as we all I think, going to talk later, that changes around about the turn of the decade. And in the 1590s, he's always kind of he's always struggling for status. You know, Essex becomes, the big figure of the Elizabethan court in the 1590s. William Cecil dies and Robert Cecil starts his rise to power. And Raleigh is always kind of struggling to get back to the kind of favour that he enjoyed before. He never really quite gets there. It's quite interesting. I mean, if he had died, around the time Elizabeth died, we would think very differently of him. But as we'll talk about later, his life has an extraordinary kind of second act, which totally transformed his reputation.
Okay, so if there's one thing that Elizabeth I disliked, it's when her courtiers and ladies-in-waiting married without her permission, which is exactly what Raleigh and Elizabeth Throckmorton do in 1591. So how did the Queen react when she discovered that they'd actually wed?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, his favours changed dramatically in 1591. I mean, we don't actually know when they married. The first kind of written record of it that we know about is Elizabeth's brother, Arthur, who found out about it on 19th November. But Elizabeth Throckmorton was pregnant by then. They had a son in March, which is kind of the point at which the wheels come off. And there were rumours circulating about court about the marriage. Cecil wrote to Raleigh saying, "Come on, what's going on?" And Raleigh flat out lied to him. This is at the end of March. I think just around the time his son's been born, and is saying, "No, if that was true, you would be the first person I would tell." He was burning bridges along the way, but not just with Elizabeth. They were both put in the Tower. So there's a period where Raleigh's kind of confined. He had a big house on the River Durham House, where the river bends round to down to Westminster, and so he was kind of like under house arrest for a while. And there's very self-dramatizing stories about having to be restrained, trying to fight his way back to get to see Elizabeth, and looking out the river and seeing her boat roam past, and wishing he could be there and row, and trying to get all these stories about how brokenhearted he is back to Elizabeth. They're both put in the Tower in August, and Raleigh kind of gets out fairly quickly. And so in September, mid-September, his men captured a Spanish ship called the Madre de Dios, which had a phenomenal amount of money on it. It was like £200,000 or something in that time. Huge amounts of wealth, and he is summoned out of the Tower to go down to the West Country. I think it's Plymouth. I think it's Dartmouth to sort everything out and make sure that the money comes in to Elizabeth eventually, rather than gets dissipated out across the West Country. So he kind of gets released. He goes down there with Cecil. Cecil is kind of fairly kind of dismissive. Sorry, this is Robert Cecil we're talking about. He's kind of really admires Raleigh's kind of ability. But Raleigh, any time Raleigh's asks, so are you free? He says, "No, I'm the Queen of England's poor captive still." And then Cecil is kind of rolling his eyes, going, "Oh, really?" But Bess, Elizabeth Throckmorton doesn't get out of the Tower till the end of the year, till 22nd December. And she was never really allowed back to court. So she's kind of like in exile, I guess. Not really in exile, in exile from where power and influence is. And Raleigh doesn't, he gets back, he never gets back really to the same kind of position of trust that he had before. I think that's why you get, one of the other many famous things in Raleigh's life, the voyage to El Dorado, in the mid-90s, that's very much a big dramatic gesture to, reclaim his place in Elizabeth's heart and favour. And obviously that didn't go very well, but I think as much as anything, that's about him trying to rebuild his relationship with her, as about the actual search for the Golden City.
Now, I recently read an article that you published on your website, and you said that not many people face the death penalty twice in court, particularly when found guilty the first time. But this is exactly what Walter Raleigh did. So, what happened after Elizabeth's death in March 1603?
It's quite complicated, but essentially. The succession of James I was orchestrated by Robert Cecil. He'd been in contact with James and James's court, and so the smooth transition to power under James was something Raleigh was very much not involved in. And James had very little time for him, partly because some of Raleigh's enemies had been briefing James, and partly because James really didn't need someone like Raleigh. In the early months of weeks and months really of James's reign, there were two plots against him. which are known as the biplot and the main plot. The biplot was a plot to kidnap him and force him to grant gracious toleration to Catholics. And whilst the authorities were investigating that, they turned up something called the main plot, which is the one that Riley was allegedly involved in, which was essentially to put Arbella Stewart on the throne using Spanish money. And so that kind of comes up under interrogation in kind of mid-July 1603, and Riley is mentioned as being part of that through his friend Henry Brooke, who was Baron Cobham. And Riley has his his sources of income get taken away, the monopolies and so on. Obviously, he loses the captaincy of the guard. His Durham house, which I mentioned earlier, which he'd been at since the early mid-1580s, is told to get out of it in 2 weeks. So, his, as well as losing status, there's a good deal of kind of humiliation going on for him. And he was he was very much a proud man. And he gets put in the tower mid-July, 19th July. The only evidence against him is that of his friend, Cobham, Henry Brooke, Lord Cobham, who was, by all accounts, a man of, explosive temper. So he accused Raleigh of having instigated this plot in essentially a huge, vast fit of pique against James, and orchestrated, getting money from Spain, 600,000 crowns or something from Spain. But then Cobham said that in a fit of temper, but then retracted it. But actually, the authorities didn't care about the retraction. It was like, well, we have this now, we have this on you. And Riley, we've talked a little bit about his tendency to be very dramatic and self-dramatized. I mean, he attempted suicide. Tower. He said he appears to attempt suicide. So a lot of people were very cynical about how genuine the attempt was. And then he goes to trial. It's a big trial in terms of kind of English legal history, and it still gets cited. It's cited by the American Supreme Court, I think 2003, 2004, because the case against him was based on Cobham's statement. There was no other evidence against him, no other witnesses, and the court refused Raleigh refused him the chance to interrogate, even to interrogate Cobham in court. As I said earlier, Raleigh was very unpopular. The court was in Winchester at the time because the plague was in London, so the trial was in Winchester, Great Hall in Winchester, November 1603, and he was taken out of the tower down there by coach, and his guards said he was so unpopular, it was touch and go whether they would actually get down there alive, because people were throwing stuff, and really, it was a very clear expression of how hated he was. One of the extraordinary things about Riley is that in a day, the trial lasted a day, he was found guilty. But he completely turned around public opinion. It's quite an extraordinary thing. There are various transcripts of the trial, and I've sort of edited them to get them together. If people want to read it, it's on my blog. There's a great quote from one of James's allies. I don't think we know who, but he said when he first saw Riley, in court, he was so led with the common hatred that he would have gone 100 miles to have seen him hanged. But by the end of the day, he would have gone 1,000 to have saved his life.
Right. Okay.
It's quite a strange thing, and we've talked earlier in terms of his influence and the position at court about his charm and his charisma, and how that must have been a very attractive quality for Elizabeth, but also was a dangerous quality for people who were his enemies. Essentially that the day in court is him arguing again and again in lots of different ways that it's unjust to try and put a man on trial for his life on the word of just one other witness, and particularly when the witness can't be interrogated in court. So it's quite a pivotal moment in terms of development of, I guess, what we would call human rights, the right to free trial and what a free trial actually means. So as I said, it gets cited a lot as an important. He obviously held himself very well. Prosecution lawyer Coke is famously bad-tempered and vituperative man, and he was haranguing Riley through the trial. Riley kind of kept his cool, and there's an exchange along the lines of Coke says to him, you're the most hated man in England, and Riley says, I think it's a close call between me and you, to be honest. he won the court. He won the courtroom. He was found guilty. But then James the First has a problem. New to the throne, important figure, suddenly huge waves of sympathy publicly and in court. So he kind of commutes the sentence to imprisonment in the tower. and there Riley is for the next 13 years. It's a very interesting trial. We think about Riley as you know, the great Elizabethan favourite, but actually that's one of the pivotal moments of his life, because he stops being the favourite and he becomes the hero. It's very strange. And he has a new kind of celebrity that he didn't have before, kind of public adoration. It's very interesting in just as a dramatic moment in his life, but as also about kind of the workings of celebrity. It's very interesting.
Yeah, so he was in prison for a long time. You mentioned 13 years, was it 13 years? And talk to us about the book. So he's there for 13 years, imprisoned in the Tower, and he writes a book. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Yeah, well, he wrote a book. He actually wrote quite a lot of stuff. But the famous book he wrote is The History of the World. Actually, it's the first part of the history of the world, because he goes up to, I think, 146 BC. And there's a nice story, I think it's apocryphal, and there's a nice story that he wrote the second part, but he threw it on the fire because the first part didn't sell well enough. I don't think that's true. But the first part of the history of the world, it's a huge thing. It's like a million words or something. I think he seems to have begun writing it sort of 1607, around then. It comes out 1614. It's kind of immediately, there's attempts to suppress it. James I doesn't like it, because whenever you get to a king, Riley almost criticizes almost every king for like abuses of power, and essentially for the kinds of things that James has done to him. Yeah, so there were attempts to suppress it for being, I think the quote is, too saucy in censoring princes. As I'm sure you know, kind of history writing in the period isn't necessarily the same as what we think history writing is. So it's really, you know, it's about it's providential history. It's about the working out of God's will through the actions of men. But it's an extraordinary achievement. There are suggestions that he didn't do it all himself. Ben Jonson, the playwright, claimed to have written some of... Ben Jonson said a lot of things when he was drunk. I don't know if you know it, but there's a book called Conversations with Drummond, which is Ben Jonson in 1618, I think. He went walked from London to Scotland and went to stay with this man Drummond in Scotland. And basically Drummond wrote down when they were drinking, you know, after dinner when Ben was drinking, he was criticising Shakespeare and all this kind of thing, and telling good stories. Drummond wrote them all down. So that's where you get that's where you get him saying that he wrote bits of Riley's history. It would not be unreasonable for him to have had help in various ways. But, you know, a lot of it, it's very Rileyan in temper. It has that kind of... There's a very particular kind of tone that Riley has. It's not exactly cynical, but there's a kind of... maybe it is cynical. There's a kind of judgment about the way that people behave, about their motives, which is quite sardonic, I guess you might say. It's cynical. He thinks people are primarily motivated by inner money and power. So things like when he talks about this, French wars of religion, is that, you know, it's all about money and power. It wasn't about religion at all. And actually, he fought. We didn't talk about it, but he fought when he was 14 or 15. He was in France for a year, and off fighting for the Huguenot cause. So he had seen a lot of this stuff close at hand. And you get one of the interesting things about the history is you do get snippets of Riley. You know, we know he was in France because he talks about it in History of the World. He uses here and there. He uses his own experiences to contextualise the things that he's writing about. So it's a very interesting book. You wouldn't sit down and read it, to be honest, but it's very interesting for what it says about Riley and for kind of how people conceived history at the time. I think in the introduction there's a passage about Henry VIII, which is very well known, which is one of the most vicious phrases of Henry VIII I've ever read.
I was just going to say that I think I've read some comments that he made about Henry that were vicious.
If you ever want, it's just something like, if you ever wanted the model of a tyrant, you have the model right here, you know. Yeah. It talks about, you know, the executions and abuses of power. It's only like a couple of paragraphs, but it's really like, wow. You can kind of imagine, you know, he kept that quiet while Elizabeth was alive.
That's what I was going to say, a safe from that distance.
Yeah. But obviously, you know, again, it's the sort of thing that, you know, put James's back up no end. Yes, it's a very interesting book. In passages, it's fascinating what it says about Riley.
Now, Matthew, there's another twist to this story. This thing, that's an incredible story already, but it doesn't kind of end there. So Riley is eventually pardoned by James I in 1617. However, he's executed in October 1618. So I imagine this is quite a complex story behind this as well. But can you give us a bit in a nutshell why... was his death sentence reinstated?
Okay, as quickly as I can. So, 16, he's released from the tower to go to El Dorado and find the gold city, all the wealth that he promised, 20, 30 years earlier. People at the time and now are kind of doubtful as to how genuine he was about finding gold, because did he just want to get out of the tower? But anyway, he does. But James, who wanted to make peace with Spain at this time, said, "You can go, but you can't, fight the Spanish." He and his men go. Raleigh kind of stays down at the coast because he's ill. But he and his men, including his son, go upriver to where they had been 30 years before, and they attack Spanish settlement. His son dies. His kind of lieutenant, who had been with him for like 30 years or so, Lawrence Gaines, who kind of led the attack, comes back. And Keynes is so distressed, he kills himself. Raleigh comes home and he's arrested, and just the Spanish are like absolutely livid. Spanish want him dead, and James wants him dead, but he struggles to find a way, because what he doesn't want is to put him on public trial again because of what happened last time. He literally says, we can't have Winchester again. So what they do, they kind of jerry-rig a kind of court of grandees, and they talk about his conduct in South America, but then... they can't really see any legal reason to execute him. So what they say is, well, the previous sentence of 1603 was never lifted. We'll just go ahead with that. So supposedly, I think this is probably true actually, but it's said that when Raleigh was freed in 1616, he talked to Francis Bacon, who I think was the Attorney General at that point, and said, look, do I need to get the death sentence annulled, or whatever the legal term would be? And Bacon says, no, you don't need to worry about that. And then Bacon is one of the people who gets him executed. Raleigh was a very keen observer of irony, and his position was, so 1603, I was sentenced to death for allying with Spain to get Spanish money to put someone on the throne. Now I'm being executed because I attacked Spain. So, how does that make any sense? He was put on trial and then executed the next day in Westminster Yard, 29th October.
What an incredible life. So obviously a lot of legends and myths have built up around Walter Raleigh over the years and the centuries. What do you think are some of the most persistent? You mentioned the cloak one, which is probably the first one that comes to mind. What do you think are the most persistent myths about him?
Well, I think probably that like the most famous ones are like him introducing tobacco, introducing the potato to Ireland, probably. Those are ones that people say to me. The answer to both of them is that he didn't. I think the thing is that tobacco was around, I think, from the mid-century in Europe, and I think in England from maybe the 1570s. But what he did was kind of make it fashionable. Obviously, he had a colony in Virginia, and tobacco is associated with Virginia. And actually, one of his men, Thomas Harriot, who was a brilliant scientist and someone who's very close to Raleigh through his life, he's the first person to die of smoking-related cancer that we know about in English history. So, it's in his circle, definitely, but he didn't introduce it by any sense. Yeah, potato and Ireland, I think people have put, Raleigh, America, potato, Ireland together and thought, oh wow, that must be how Ireland got potatoes. But there's almost no evidence of that. I mean, potatoes weren't, I think, a popular crop until, maybe 200 years after Raleigh died. It's not true.
All right, well, there we go. We've clarified some things. I like doing a bit of myth busting. It's always good. So Matthew, you're currently working on a new book, a book about the dissolution of the monasteries. Can you give some snippets about this particular project?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the thing about the dissolution of the monasteries is it's such a pivotal moment in English history. Arguably there's been nothing like it since 1066 in terms of transfers of wealth and land. It's in the space of 3, 4, 5 years, Peter Asia of 1,000 years of English history. It's quite an extraordinary thing. My feeling is when you read about it, it's very much written kind of, it's either written in terms of, the Protestant narrative of we swept away, all this Catholic papist nonsense, or it's viewed from the institutional perspective of the monastic orders. But I mean, when I was looking at it, it's such an extraordinary human story.
Yes.
Because the monasteries were, obviously they were centres of wealth and centres of learning, but they were, so embedded in English society, in English life. And, drive around the country now, you can't help but see how embedded they still are, you know, they're so embedded in the literal fabric of the nation. But, you know, they were the health service of the day. You know, they were very important in education. And, you know, a lot of that just went overnight. You know, there were, I don't know, 815 monasteries or something like that. There were, on top of that, were another 500-600 hospitals and almshouses run by the religious orders. So the thing that interests me is that you have this kind of very important, like, political story being told about, you know, about the Reformation, and obviously it ties into, you know, the divorce from Rome and what's going on at the Henrician court. But you, beneath that, you have all these interesting stories, you know, almost on a house-by-house basis of what's happening to the people and to the land and who's getting rich off of it. And you have, you know, obviously some of the monastic communities, you know, lost their lives because they refused to submit to Henry. There was the Pilgrimage of Grace, a huge, huge uprising, you know, 40,000 people marching south, basically as a result. There were lots of reasons why it happened, but as a result of Henry's Reformation, but also the actions of Cromwell's men as they travelled north to visit the monastic houses. It's a very kind of rich 3, 4, 5 years in English history, and I think the human stories haven't really been told, I don't think, and that's kind of what I'm hoping to do. For me, one thing, interesting things, but I was raised atheist, so it's kind of been very interesting for me, kind of wrapping my head around what monastic houses were, kind of in why people went into them, what the histories were, and the history of monastic England is something I'd never thought about before, but it's actually, you know, hugely important in terms of in its political life and its religious life. So it's been like a huge learning curve for me, just aside from the you know, the day-to-day history of the dissolution itself.
Yeah, I find it quite fascinating. I did a bit of reading about them, and it's one of those rabbit holes that you fall into, and you could be in there for months and months and months.
Yes, it is.
All right, fantastic. I look forward to that. So, Matthew, at the end of our episodes, we always do a little 10 to go, which are just 10 questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready for these 10 questions?
Yes, go.
What's one of your favourite Tudor films, movies or series?
You know, probably like Shakespeare in Love. I know it's cheesy, but it just makes me laugh every time I see it. And I really like the way they've dramatised the theatre. I think that's really brilliantly done. So yeah, I don't know. It's tricky, isn't it? I mean, I probably should say like Wolf Hall or something, which, you know, obviously is brilliant.
Thanks, man. Love, it's brilliant. I know. I was just saying that to another person that I was chatting to. I said, yeah, I haven't seen it in years, but I feel like I want to rewatch it now because you're the second person to mention it. So I think that's a sign. So what are two things that are on your bucket list?
That's a good question. Well, I'd love to go to Japan. Got into through my kids, really. I got into Japanese anime like about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. That totally opened up a new world for me, kind of that I didn't really know existed. And that's got me very interested in Japanese culture and Japanese life and Japanese food, my God. So that would be number one. Number two, I'd love to go to the Arctic Circle. I don't actually have a bucket list, but those are two things that come to mind.
Excellent. All right. So when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, depending, when I was like 10, I wanted to fly aeroplanes. Specifically, I wanted to fly World War One aeroplanes, the old kind of biplanes and stuff. I was obsessed with those when I was like 10, 11, 12 or something. Later on, I think I just wanted to do something to do with books. It wouldn't matter what it was, you know, librarian, you know, whatever. I don't know, you know, around books.
Something bookish. Excellent. Yes. Very good. And so what's a book that you would recommend everyone to read? Perhaps one of your favourites?
Ooh. I don't know about favourite. The book I've read this year that I've recommended to everyone talked to is a book by an American writer called Daniel Mendelsohn called An Odyssey. Daniel Mendelsohn teaches classical literature, I guess, and it's about teaching the Odyssey to his class, but also a bit about his relationship with his father, who, you know, in the years before he died, he sat in on Daniel's class, and it's brilliant in the way that it winds together, talking about the Odyssey and how it's structured, talking about his relationship with his father, which, you know, had its ups and downs, and talking about his students. It's so brilliantly done. Particularly if you write stuff, you look at how other people are doing things, and the way he weaves the different things together and talks in such a light but informative way about sort of storytelling and the Odyssey and the structure and so on. It's, and then you can see that reflection in the way that he's done the book. You think, God, that's so clever. But it's really, really good book. Highly recommend that.
Great. Another one for the long TBR list. What's an inspirational place that you like to visit that's close to your home?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, I'm tempted to just say London. I mean, I live in London, but like the City of London, yes. You know, I love walking around the City of London. I love being down by the river in the city. I love being on the Thames foreshore. There's some places in the city where you can get down onto the foreshore, down around Queen's Hythe and so on. That really makes you feel very connected with the history of the city, and you know, it's there in the place names, and obviously there are things that you know happened in various places in the city. So that's probably that. I know it's quite general, but yeah, the Thames in the city.
No, that sounds good. Have you ever tried your hand at a bit of mudlarking?
No, actually, that could be a bucket list thing. I mean, it's quite low level as a bucket list thing, but I definitely would love to do that. Yeah. It's one of the things I've got around to doing, but yeah, definitely.
It's on my bucket list too. I want to, hopefully, I can have a go next year when I visit. So, Matthew, what do you do to recharge the batteries?
Watch movies.
That's okay, you know, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, watch movies and drink wine, you know.
I like it. That sounds good. Yeah. So connected to that, what's the last film that you watched?
I think the last film I saw was Judy. I don't actually go to the cinema very much, so you know, I watch stuff on DVD. Judy, which is Renée Zellweger's brilliant performance. It's a great performance in a good but not great film, I would say.
Right, yeah, I heard really good things about her performance. Yeah. So what is your go-to comfort food?
Well, I'm tempted to say wine, but
liquid food.
Yeah, it's probably something like baked potato with cheese, something like that.
Yeah.
Your comfort.
Anything with potatoes, I think, is always a good thing. I'm a potato lover. I think I had a past life in Ireland, and that's why that's my story. Anyway, what are some qualities, two or three qualities, that you admire and value in friends?
Kindness, humour. Those would be probably the two big ones.
Lucky last, I'm sure there are lots of people listening, lots of our listeners, you know, that want to write their own books, either a non-fiction or a work of fiction. Do you have any advice for them?
I'd say pretty much every writer I know kind of has a lot of self-doubt, and you know, the blank page is terrifying, and a lot of anxieties about you know, how their work will be and whether they can do it. I think one of the things I like about Twitter, I mean, Twitter has you know, lots of thoughts. One of the nice things about it is kind of like the writing community on it, and yes. There's lots of people going through the same kinds of anxieties and you know, worries that you have, but you think, oh God, I'm the only one. Don't worry about what someone's going to think reading your work. Write the thing that you want to write. Don't let your fears put you off or stop you doing what you want to do. And everyone's first drafts are terrible. You know, don't worry about that. The whole point of writing, someone said writing is rewriting, I think. You know, just write. I'd say don't be afraid, just write.
Yeah, that's brilliant advice. Just write. I have to keep that in mind too, I think. And the very, very, very last thing, Matthew, I promise, is the Tudor takeaway. So I always ask my guests for a Tudor takeaway. So something for our listeners to go and check out after the episode, website, book, film, anything. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Yeah, I thought about this and, wondering lots of different things. I'm going to say John Stowe's Survey of London, which, you know, tying back to what I was saying about the city earlier, it's such a fantastic guide to, you know, the city that all these people that we're fascinated about, you know, the city that they, you know, walk through or rode through, sail through on the river, you know, every day. And it's so rich in history and the texture of the time. It's a really, really interesting book. There's new things in it every time I look at it.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And in something, you know, 50 plus episodes, no one's ever mentioned that as their takeaway. So that's brilliant and unique. So I love it. Thank you. And Matthew, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it was very early when we recorded for you. So thanks for taking the time to talk to Judas with me. And I look forward to hearing more about your current book as well.
Thank you very much. Very nice to talk to you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.